This is the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. Your hosts, Sam Harris and Nicholas Farik, digest the most interesting, informative, and topical books, giving you their biggest insights. We expose different perspectives and tools to look at the world to make you wiser than yesterday.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. My name is Nico. As usual, I'm joined by Sam. And today we are starting a new season. In this season, we are reading and discussing mainly business books. So perhaps, Sam, you can tell us which books we're selecting and why we're reading these specific books.
So my company, Thinkify, has just been funded by Techstars, and they're giving me a reading list of 10 books to read whilst we're on the accelerator to business knowledge info stuff, like investing, scaling your business, how to start a business, marketing, all these kind of things. So as I kind of have a lot of reading to do anyway, it makes sense to read the same things as Nico and save myself time, because I'm kind of rather busy, and Nico has gladly accepted.
Absolutely. There's so many business books, and I think a well-known accelerator like Techstars probably has a very good idea of which are valuable, and so I think it's also very interesting for us just to read them and think, okay, why would this be valuable for an accelerator program?
Right? Definitely.
Why is it relevant for tech startups these days? Because this book is well, actually, we haven't talked about it yet. So Sam and I just finished reading the book Shoe Dog, written by Phil Knight, and so it tells a story about the founding of Nike from the earliest days up until its IPO, and not too much after that. So it goes quite deep into the personal life of Phil Knight, its founder, and all the struggles that they had in the first decades of the company. And so the most of the whatever happened before like 1980. So how did you enjoy reading or listening to the book?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was a good story, made a bit of a difference compared to like the philosophy ones, which were a bit harder to digest.
My God. This was a breath of fresh air. This was like a blast listening to.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I mean,
it was like, it's super easy for a business book even, because it's just a story, and it's really nice, well-told story. Yes. He's not a bad writer, I think.
Actually, I thought the same. I was like, what, this guy knows how to write? And I looked it up, and he's actually used a ghostwriter, who's called J.R. Moringer, who also wrote other people's memoirs. So
interesting.
That might explain, but still, because quite a lot, often it's going like really a lot into detail about stuff that happened like 60 years ago, but still it's pretty cool.
I do wonder how people like do these memoirs if they haven't been keeping a diary the whole time. So I've been keeping a diary for like, the last few years, but it'd be kind of hard for me to sort of go really deep into the, especially when they sort of recount conversations with people. And you're like, did anyone say those specific words, or was it just like a general, like,
they just probably filled it in, you know? It's like when they make movies about certain events, you know, they have to fill in some blanks and some conversation fit, but it all fits together quite well, and it's pretty consistent all the time, like the people, characters, and it's all, well, it flows pretty well. And so I think we all know how it ended. Like, Nike is a huge business today. It's personally for me very known for its very good marketing.
Yeah.
In my company, our marketing guy is like a huge fan of Nike, and we tried to think, okay, what would Nike do in our case? You know. So
yeah, that was some really nice insights. As in, I remember, so initially more of a reseller for a Japanese brand, and then they kind of started partnering with a different manufacturer, and they kind of just made up it took them ages to get to the tick. I think they were like going through different things, but like the name he just sort of made up on the day, and then like a bunch of like the first set of, like, they're now like considered all the classics, like all the names and stuff. I can't remember any of the names, but he's kind of made them up in like half an hour of like had a bit of a roll. I was like, oh yeah, we'll have this one, and animal names and stuff, and and you're like, oh cool, it's like epic sort of thing that sort of seems like a part of like history almost. It's just like half an hour of him just like writing some random stuff down on a whiteboard.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, he started off by reselling Japanese Tigers, they're called, from a company based in Kobe in Japan. And after 6 years did they start making a shoe that they called Nike, because first their company was called Blue Ribbon Sports, and then they changed the name afterwards, and then the Nike name stuck. But I mean, I would recommend, like, I wouldn't go too much into detail on the book. I think if this story interests you, go ahead and listen to it or read it. It is super easy to read. So like when you're commuting, when you're in your car, even when you're like doing a walk or you're doing a run, it's very, very accessible to listen to. So I would highly recommend to do it. But then I think we can go into the learnings, like what stuck to us. If you think about the book now, what will you always remember?
I think I remember you kind of identify with his sort of his issue with his parents, kind of not really wanting him to do that, and like sort of reluctantly being like, oh, okay, well, I'll try this idea for a bit, and then it not like taking off but not failing, and him like going further with it, and they're like, okay, maybe you could like get a job now, and like it just carried on like that for sort of like the first 3 or 4 years before he finally was like had enough. And like, but he had these same conversations with the banks as well of them trying to borrow more and more money because he couldn't get like venture funding back in those days, and like they just were like, well, companies don't really grow as such that quickly or anything, so like we don't want to give you any more money than you've already taken before. And it's just sort of, it's a strange time in that sense. But like on the family side, I definitely sort of identified with the whole like, maybe you just get a job and stop like trying these sort of crazy ideas, and just sort of having the persistence to kind of back yourself on like some big vision that you probably haven't actually fully worked out what the vision is, but you sort of know that there's something there.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think it feels like if you listen to the book that the company was about to go bankrupt, like for the first 15 years of its existence.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like constantly struggling with cash flow. Like the bank accounts were as good as empty. Like they were living on borrowed time, basically. And it was, yeah, it's pretty crazy, like how much trouble they had in that department. And especially, I think it contrasts to today, because in that time, there was no such thing as real venture capital. There were no VC firms. There was no companies specifically investing in startups. And so the only money he could find was like from people he knew, and he didn't know any like super rich people, like any angel investors that could help him out with like $1 million or something. So basically he had to go to his bank, and these banks were not happy to loan him money. So very large part of the book is him describing struggles with his banker, who was complaining that he didn't have enough equity to get that big a loan, basically.
And it's interesting because of, I mean, you think about it now and it seems sort of like obvious, like the Nike brand's so huge, but like it was sort of, it had like a crap name, and it was just some guys like reselling Japanese trainers out of the back of their boots. And you're like, he didn't really he obviously had some kind of vision that it could be big, but he hadn't like thought of it in the way that it became big at all. And
Except
it was 6 years in before they started like, oh, maybe we could start our own brand. And they had like a few different names, and they had some other names that they thought were more correct. And like, I think they got one person in to give some ideas. She just was like, oh, maybe Nike. And then like, no one quite disliked it enough with the other names. And so they kind of just went with that because they couldn't think of anything else. And then you're like, but relentlessly backed himself so much when it wasn't even the idea that we kind of all identify with. Now it seems obvious. Like we talk about people sort of being lucky almost, and it's kind of like he just sort of gave himself the possibility to be lucky by keeping on like doing it, or he didn't actually sort of plan to do what happened, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I feel like there is quite a big contrast with someone like, for example, Elon Musk. Like Elon Musk, he starts with a vision and he's like, okay, I'm building something, and it's going toward that vision. The way Phil Knight portrayed himself, like his own vision and path in this book, is like completely the other way around. It's like, okay, we bootstrap something, it works, and like people just really like it and it just keeps growing. I don't know what's happening, but I need more stuff, you know, give me more supply, I need more shoes, man. And then I need to find extra factories. And some guy suddenly came to me with a new type of shoe. Let's try it out. You know, people like it. Okay, let's keep selling it. And, you know, it's quite interesting the way he approached it.
Yeah. Then I've read some books about like how people write books as such. And like there's two styles. Like most people tend to plan it out and sort of work out what the point of the book is, and then kind of go for like a chapter sort of headings, and then kind of fill in like the details and sort of slowly like put it together. And the other one is just like, just start writing and like just write anything. And so Stephen King, that's like, it's called like Seat of the Pants or something, and you don't even know where the story's going or where it's going to end, and you just kind of like sit there with these characters, you just sort of like make it up as you go along. And he definitely was like the latter, it felt like.
Yeah, it feels like for the first 15 years it was just problem solving. Because one of the takeaways I always so had from the book, me and I think you as well, we are most involved in the tech scene. And in the tech scene, like if there's demand, you'll be successful. There's like never a supply issue. Because if you have a tech company, in theory, a tech product is infinitely scalable almost. If you produce something digital, code, you know, you can copy paste it a million times and it's not going to lose anything.
Yeah, you just have like failure, like things break or outage issues and stuff, but you don't really have like a supply as such. I mean, certainly scaling things isn't completely easy, but
no,
like, I mean, I guess the equivalent might be like supply of developers, which is your constant nightmare trying to grow a tech business. You're like, fuck, where do I get more developers?
Yes, but in this case, so Phil Knight, in the first years, the biggest issue that he had, like 80% of his issues were on the supply side and not so much on the demand side. So there was always people asking for the shoes and he just couldn't find a way to get the supply. He had a lot of issues with his initial Japanese providers, which is one of the reasons why he switched. And so it, I found quite perplexing because I always thought if the demand is there, you'll be successful. But this book made me realize that supply is also a big part of it. And it also made me respect companies that produce something more, you know, that also have a supply chain to manage, because it's more than only marketing. You know, you also have to get the goods there and make sure they're like, have both sides.
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting one, because you always sort of see the problems that you have in your own sector, then like trying to find developers or sort of trying to work out what the product is that people want. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh yeah, I mean, just building a business isn't tech. It's just like being a secretary or something. You don't really do much. It's just sort of like... putting X together, but it is.
And in the tech world, if you know what people want, that's all you need to know, right? If you know what they want, then you just make it and it's going to be all right. It's the trouble, like in this case, it's a whole different world. It's that's quite interesting. And there, I think, so over the past years, and also in this Corona crisis, there's a lot of people who are like hating on the billionaires of this world because they made so much money. And it's always, they're always comparing like the minimum wage workers and they're comparing their salaries to that of the owners of the company. You know, Jeff Bezos like earns like a million times as much as the people working in his warehouses, etc. But if you read this book, you realize that these entrepreneurs, like, it's not easy money in a way, you know, it's like the troubles they had to get through, the things they put at risk. Like if Phil Knight at so many points in his company's lifetime, like they were one thing going wrong away from being completely bankrupt. Right. Yeah. If they weren't lucky, 100%. It would have gone bankrupt for like 10 times in the company's life.
Yeah. I mean, we say it's an easy book to read. It's slightly stressful in the same way that like reading a scary book or something might scare you. This book is, you're constantly a bit like, oh, what's gonna go wrong now? Yeah,
exactly. But then in the end, you know, like if you look at the shoes you're wearing, you're like, okay, they survived in some way, you know. So you know that it's there's a good ending. But I mean, it's, the book is full of problems and struggles that you have to overcome. And so people don't seem to realize that, like, what struggles these entrepreneurs have gone through to get where they are now. Like they see these guys who are now just basically chilling and just earning money off the dividends of the companies that they don't even run, for example. And they find that unfair, but this guy, like, he put his life at risk. Like he had two kids and if the company would have gone bankrupt, he was nowhere, you know. He had accounting skill, but like as far as career advancement goes, he didn't have much experience there.
Yeah. I mean, they do say that like, it's not that the people usually do it for the money. It's more because they want to change things. But if like every CEO that like got to that point then had their company taken off them and didn't get anything for it, you would kind of think that people probably wouldn't bother innovating as such. Because you sort of want the control to like,
I did get the feeling from the book, but again, I mean, this is obviously, it's written by Phil Knight, so he's going to put himself in a good light. Although he does criticize himself, but not too harshly, but he makes it seem like everything was done, you know, for the shoes basically, and for the running and for the company and for building a brand and not for the money, which is nice. I mean, it seems nice. I don't know if it's 100% true, but at least that's how it comes across.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos, they did always put like the customer at the front of like the decisions that they made. They're always like, okay, we have to give like the best value to the customer. Apple, like they make lots of decisions based around like, they're taking things out. It's like, well, we want to make like the simplest thing that like customers can love and enjoy without like all the extra faff and shit.
And in the end, I think what a lot of people miss is that I think that's the magic of capitalism. It's that if you produce something of value to society, you will be rewarded. And so all the incentives are aligned. Like if Nike had never existed, our world would look different and probably look worse. You know, there would have been way less innovation in shoes. Someone else might have filled the gap, obviously. But I mean, if, for example, what's happening today with the Vaporfly, I think it's called, like these new shoes of Nike, which were used to break the 2-hour mark on the marathon and stuff. It's insane, cool. The innovation in that space. And I think that would never have happened if Nike didn't exist. And so all of these people, these billionaires, these billionaire entrepreneurs, they just add like massive value to society, and they capture part of that value, but still people are happy to pay for the products that they produce. So I don't really see why it's unfair that they earn so many rewards from that. One of the things I liked from the book was the fact that Phil Knight seemed quite human, and he wasn't portrayed like a demigod who always knew exactly what to do and made all the right decisions. It was like this genius who was like, oh no, we're going to do it this way. A bit like, you know, Steve Jobs was like, okay, I want exactly this. And it was correct, you know. And in the case of Phil Knight, it didn't really seem that way. He felt like more human. And I think for me, the book made, you know, this American dream of building a company and becoming hugely successful, it made it feel quite attainable, because he didn't, like nothing he did is something that I would say of, I would never have been able to do that because I don't have that specific.
As in he kind of like, he didn't sort of say, oh, well, like when I saw the Nike Swish logo, I was immediately like, like the name. He's kind of like, well, we kind of randomly made some things and those are the ones that ended up with it. And then like after the tick, they were trying to work out why it was good. Like, well, I guess they started like backwardsly working out why it was such a great branding move and sort of being like, oh, you kind of see the tick as you like, get left behind in the Swish kind of thing as runners pass you and stuff and the kind of things. And like, and when he made up the names for the first set of shoes, he sort of was like, yeah, I think that this would be good, but almost like it wasn't even him, like it sort of just had like a moment where it's actually slightly smart for once and then made up these names and it seemed like a good idea and then people liked it, but it's not like he was sort of driven by this for ages and that was like his purpose or something. And I quite liked all of the stuff around like his employees and how he worked with his business partner. It's kind of interesting. And because he kind of gave 50% to this guy that didn't seem to do all that much initially, but then did have the odd moments of inspiration and clearly was like quite critical in the business and like invented some of like the innovations behind the shoe and really got it into the running sort of scene because he was like a head coach and like worked with lots of Olympic athletes and this stuff. But the guy did seem to spend most of his time like completely unconcerned with the business and just sort of coaching people. And occasionally once every few years, he sort of like come up with some ideas. So that was kind of like an odd one.
But it didn't really seem as if Phil Knight complained about that.
I felt
So I think it was all fair because I think the name of, because you're talking about Bowerman. And so he was very known as a coach for runners in the US, and so he was the co-founder of Nike, but didn't indeed like in the book you don't really doesn't seem like he had a lot of influence on the business part. He was more like he was like a real shoe dog who was like, you know, like putting shoes together and tearing them apart just to understand the the best shape to fit a runner's foot and all that stuff. So he was probably the real innovator.
It was interesting. I guess it'd be sort of like if you had a business idea, but you're working with like someone that runs like a scientist at sort of your university lecturer or something, and you're kind of starting a business with them and they kind of don't really come on board, but they sort of have the insights and marketing. I don't know. It was interesting. And also like he didn't know him that well. Cause I remember they had like a board meeting or something like with some investors and then like he got drunk and he was like, didn't even realize that he got drunk really easily and was generally embarrassing and this stuff. And then his first employee that Ian like did the complete opposite with, like he didn't give him any of the company, even though this guy was like critical and like started their first base on the other side of the country and stuff. And then he was like asking for like some of the business and some more money, and then he was like, yeah, well, I guess no, even though like you're probably the most important person in the business right now. And you're like, it seemed a bit odd.
I don't want to lose control, basically. That was that felt quite, I don't know, selfish in a way, but then it obviously worked out for him. And like, I found it very crazy how passionate his team was without being incentivized at all. That was something that stuck to me. Like the first 10 employees were all like they were basically living and breathing Nike without having any like options, something that you would definitely consider giving to your employees, especially if you get like start giving or yeah. getting more than 1 million in revenue and the company was getting
private. It doesn't seem like they had a mission that's going to change the world as such. And to us now,
yeah,
it's sort of because like, I mean, at the time they weren't called Nike or anything fantastic, but I guess they must have had like, it must have for the time been really cool, as in to be associated with like sort of the ultra runners, well, like the runners of the scene, and being able to get hold of good shoes compared to like what was kind of crap and otherwise available or something. I don't know. It must have been like a really exciting brand, even though it doesn't sound that exciting to us because it's called Blue Ribbon. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I guess maybe a bit like sort of the skate scene or something. Perhaps it was just sort of like, you know, something cool to be around.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
That's a book actually would be quite interesting. Like Tony Hawk's got a pretty fascinating life. He was sort of around like at the start as like a 14-year-old, and then sort of now he's sort of late 40s, but he's still like on the scene and and like he has like a massive influence on like making it a big thing. But yeah, I mean he did feel like the first explosion of it, and then like death, and then sort of re-kicked off the whole popularity in it. Anyway, completely unrelated, but similar in like the sort of brandy feeling of, I think like running was sort of an exciting place, but not like a huge.
No, it wasn't. It was definitely not as popular as it is now. And yeah. I feel like sports in general, like if I ask my grandparents, for example, they didn't do any sports at all.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole like concepts of gyms and that kind of stuff was like so new.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at like videos of the 60s and 70s of like people playing rugby or that kind of stuff, and they were just like skinny people like running around fields. And you're like, if you put any of like the famous old rugby players in a match now, they would get destroyed instantly.
Yeah.
They have no chance.
And if you put like a rugby player of today, like in a team back in the 60s, they would run over everyone.
It's like a bull in a giant.
One thing I also took away was, and he's quite honest on that, is that he didn't have a lot of time because he spent so much time on Nike. He didn't have a lot of time to spend with his sons. And so there it was hard for him to find a balance. And I think that is, if you're doing something as big as building a company, I think it's going to be very hard to combine that successfully with having a family, because you need to be able to dedicate so much time to doing this, because if you don't spend the, let's say 12 hours a day, someone else will, and because they spend more time, they'll be the one being successful, you know. And today it's even more true. So I find it interesting, and it's something to everyone's always like, oh, I envy these billionaires, oh, they're super rich, super successful, and they found their passion and they just chased it. But in the end, quite a lot of billionaires and these people are like separated or divorced or have had different marriages, and
definitely you'll miss out on like things that you can never really get back as such. I interviewed Graham Hobson a month ago. He's like the founder of Photobox, who then bought like out Moonpig. But he had a pretty similar sort of story, I guess, of like kind of making it up as going along for like 15 years, and somehow like didn't really feel like he was the person to even be a CEO, and like never had like 1 year where they did anything crazy and it like exploded. They just sort of never failed each year, managed to grow, and then like sort of at some point managed to like acquire a different company when they're trying to spread out across Europe, and eventually became like this huge group. But he missed out on like all of his kids really, and sort of retired and is taking it easy now for the last 3 years. But his kids are like going to uni, and he's like, well, yeah, I mean, it would have been nice to like maybe spend a bit more time with the kids, and feels like he's trying to make up for it now, but
it's not the same, man.
Yeah.
Opportunity costs. It's not easy.
When you're young, it sounds like a thing that you're really passionate about, and like it's kind of cool. But if you are really passionate about doing other things, that, I mean, it's the same with anything there as well. And so many people work in a job until they're like 60, expecting to retire and have like live all their dreams. And you're like, I mean, most of my dreams involve doing things where like I'm kind of younger. Like I couldn't have climbed the Matterhorn when I was 60, I don't think. And there's all these things that you sort of need to like fit into your life whilst you can do them. And also you might die, or like I did have a friend that his mum or something died like literally like half a year before she retired, and dad obviously had plans to do lots of nice things with his mum, and I can't, and obviously they're doing other stuff, but like it's I wouldn't wait too much But when you're running a company, you don't have such a choice. And I got asked last night by the guy that runs Techstars, like, what my next big adventure was. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm going to the Arctic. But I had quite a few other things that I was maybe going to book, but I haven't, because I guess this is my adventure now. And probably don't want to die, things going on. And just don't know when I'm going to have time. Because like, the Matterhorn was, it was like a lot of faff training for it and having the time out and stuff. It's kind of trying to be able to do it in a good way. I mean, Richard Branson's done a really good job of having like work-life balance and like doing adventure and scaling to run like multiple companies. And basically he just has like a phone call with each one each week, and that's about it. And yeah, it's kind of interesting. Whereas most people don't do that. They just have their lives taken off them.
Yeah, but it does speak for the, you know, the 9-to-5 attitude where you, you just do your thing. Like, and when you get home, you're not stressed out, because he talks about himself, you know, getting home every night, calling someone, like calling his dad, you know, just complaining the whole time. And I noticed that myself, like I've been in the company that was like struggling financially for a while. We had troubles raising capital, and it eats at you, even if you don't realize it. You know, you're constantly thinking about it. You're lying in bed awake, you're stressed.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't help your relationships either, because you're stressed and so you don't react in the best ways. I used to have like some kind of contempt for people who were just satisfied with their 9-to-5 job, but
but now I kind of have a bit of respect. I definitely am like, oh, you can just be happy? What? What's this?
Just satisfied in this? Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to be like, what's wrong with these idiots? Like, and I'm like, I feel like I'm the idiot a lot of the time. What's wrong with me? Yeah.
All right. You wanna do like a recap and a reading?
Good book. Read to enjoy and learn. Lots of insights on sort of Nike and how that kind of world got built, and just sort of the differences in business compared to now. I think it's got sort of, it's kind of like a bit of a history book as well as autobiography and businessy, economic, lots of stuff to take home. And it's really digestible. So I would say, I'm confused on my rating system again. I think a 7.5. I mean, I would recommend it to anyone that was interested, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. So for me, I think the book didn't really make me that much wiser than yesterday, but I do not regret reading the book at all, because it was very entertaining. Like, it's like just a nice story.
Yeah. And really motivating. Cause like a lot of the business books you read for something that sort of motivate you, cause they make you feel like you can do something. And then like, there are specific tools that they give you, but then you forget them all anyway. Yeah. And there's this one, doesn't try to study a specific tool, but it is kind of motivating of like, oh, you can kind of persist and like fight through all these terrible moments. And like, that might be like a more important lesson than half of the other business books that you read anyway.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
So in that sense, it's really good and motivating. So it's really useful.
Man, you make it harder for me to say that I was going to give it a 6. I'm still going to give it a 6. It's really, really easy to read, really digestible, which is a very big plus. But in general, I think I learned way more from like philosophy books. That's just how I try to compare this.
I think it depends, as in maybe if you read lots of philosophy books, you'll start getting the philosophical aspects of this book. Whereas if you just read this book, you might not have perceived this wisdom that was there for you.
Deep.
Who knows?
Deep, man. All right.
Yeah. Good.
Very good. So that's a round up the episode. Yeah, I would highly recommend just read the book. It's really nice. Don't expect to learn any like groundbreaking things, but you'll definitely enjoy your time listening or reading it. All right. Then I guess we see you next week. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. As you know, we are doing this to try and help you get smarter. Well, I have another project for podcast listeners just like you who want to be smart. Nico and I learned so much from reading the same things together and discussing them, and I wanted there to be a tool that made it easy for anyone to listen to the same podcasts and books together with their friends. So I'm building the app Syncify, which does just that. It connects you with your friends in the app, listen to the same things at the same time, or create shared playlists and work through them at your own pace. You can share comments and highlights of your favorite bits and become smarter by seeing what your friends think around the same content that you enjoy. As a bonus, it also helps with your mental health and reduces isolation. Personally, I hate publishing my life on social media, which I find all rather antisocial, and I don't go out of my way to phone a friend for no reason other than the fact I feel lonely. I do love doing things with other people, and having my friends listen to the same things is really awesome. I mean, I used to speak to Nico like once a year before we started this book club together, and now we talk all the time because we're just doing something together. So do yourself a favor and sign up for the Syncify app at syncifyapp.com, and I really hope it helps. Thanks a lot for listening. If you enjoyed the show or learned anything new, be sure to share it with your friends. And I just can't tell you how great it is if you were to happen to leave a review on iTunes. These really do help quite a lot. If you have any questions or books that you'd like us to read, feel free to reach out to us through the website, wiserpod.com, or reach out to us on LinkedIn. And just keep loving and keep learning, and ideally, keep listening. Big love from Sam and Nico, and the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast.